Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 8th, 2016. I am host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a public affairs radio program formed through a special collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. On this week's show, we depart from our regular format to bring you a special tribute to the life and legacy of independent journalist and radio producer Kelia Romaris-Watson, who passed away on August 18th of 2015. For the next 60 minutes, we'll bring you excerpts from Kelia's work over the course of her career, comments from past colleagues, and some reflections on Kelia's contributions over the years. As well, we'll hear from the one and only interview the Global Research News Hour ever conducted with Kelia Romaris-Watson in the spring of 2014. We hope you'll stay tuned. Kelia Romaris grew up in New York City. She attended Fordham University, where she graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree with honors in economics in 1977. She went on to attain the Juris Doctor degree in law from Indiana University Bloomington in 1980. She worked in legal publishing for 12 years. An unlikely beginning for someone known today primarily for her work as an independent broadcast and print journalist. Kelia's involvement with broadcasting began in March of 1999. At that time, she was living in Oakland, California, and had just become a member of Pacifica radio station, KPFA, in Berkeley. As is the case with community radio, Kelia was an unpaid volunteer. She worked in the station's newsroom for about 11 years before leaving in July of 2010, although she would return briefly a few years later. In addition to her work at KPFA, Kelia Romaris-Watson contributed to a number of other media outlets. These include the Women's International News Gathering Service, or WINGS, the Monitor on Pacifica station KPFT in Houston, the Intrepid Report, formerly Online Journal, Free Speech Radio News, various IndieMedia.org websites, National Native News, Workers Independent News, Global Public Media, and Global Research. Kelia Romaris-Watson was especially devoted to the subject of alternative economics and would eventually embrace the concept of demonetization, the viewpoint that society should abandon not only capitalism, but money itself. Let's listen to some audio from a video she made which encapsulates this philosophy.
After 40 years as a dependable American worker, Dennis Paul Abrams was let go from his last factory job at the age of 55. He managed for 2 years unemployed, going most of the last year with only food stamps to help out. During that time, he became very ill. It was cancer. Out of money, sick, out of time, too proud to ask his ex-wife and his grown sons for help, Dennis Paul Abrams took his life last August. 2 months after watching his youngest son graduate from community college. How many Dennises are there in the world that we don't know about? How can the United States or any other nation in the world call itself civilized when it expects people like Dennis to earn a living and then prevents them from doing that very thing by throwing them out of the labor force? Why do we have to earn a living anyway? Aren't we already living? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm very strongly in favor of work. But there are two true purposes for work. One is to deepen and enhance our experience as human beings. Life would be shallow and boring without work. And the second is to provide goods and services for our community. But it's certainly not the purpose of work to fatten the bottom line of some greedy corporation that'll only throw us away when it doesn't need us anymore. And certainly the purpose of work is not to pay for our very existence. In fact, money can impede work. Are you doing what you're meant to do in this life? Or are you just working a job that lets you exist to pay bills because you can't afford to get the education or tools that you need for your true work? Why must we pay to live on the planet we're born on? in 1990, Vincent van Gogh's portrait of Dr. Gachet sold for $82.5 million. Van Gogh in his life only sold one painting, and for a hell of a lot less than that. He was supported throughout his life by his younger brother, Theo. What if Vincent van Gogh had been an only child? The end of money is an idea that transcends socialism. Socialists often talk about the human right to a job. But what is a job other than a human rental? You rent yourself out to another entity for that entity's purposes for as long as that entity wants you, regardless of your needs. Human rental has a lot in common with prostitution and slavery. You've heard of the phrase wage slave, haven't you? I don't think being a whore or a slave is much of a human right. Professor Robert Reich of UC Berkeley, a Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, recently wrote an article explaining how corporate profits have been divorced from job creation. I think worker sustenance should be independent of job creation also. What's good for the goose is good for the gander, eh? Current global economics will continue to create war, crime, environmental degradation, and untimely death. We need a new way that honors the earth, the diversity of people, and the good things that people do that are not currently honored because they're not profitable. Why must we pay to live on the planet we're born on?
Kellia Ramaris Watson, unlike many journalists in much of the so-called alternative or progressive media, was not afraid to challenge the official narrative of 9/11. She was particularly enamored with the work of the late investigative journalist Michael Rupert. Her association with Rupert would shape her views on geopolitics, peak oil, and the environmental crisis, as well as economics, and ultimately contributed to her disenchantment with KPFA, among other progressive media organs that likewise shied away from alternative 9/11 coverage. I recently had a chance to speak with someone who worked closely with Kellia Ramaris during her early days at KPFA. Making her debut on the Global Research NewsHour is Bonnie Faulkner. Bonnie Faulkner is the long-serving producer and host of the program Guns and Butter, a one-hour public affairs program which airs on Pacifica radio stations KPFA and WBAI. Listeners may not be aware that Kellia Ramaris was a co-founder and early producer of the show more than 15 years ago. Bonnie is here to share some of her memories of Kellia and thoughts about her contribution to community radio and independent journalism. Good evening, Bonnie, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Michael, and I'd also like to thank you so much for doing this show on Kellia Ramaris. As you and I spoke on the phone, and I agree, she really is an unsung hero on so many levels. I would like to start by saying that Kellia and I worked together in the KPFA news department in 2001 and 2002. We were both volunteer field reporters, news reporters. That's how we met. We hit it off right away. Kellia had more experience there than I, but she liked my ideas. I wanted to do economic and financial reporting, which was basically non-existent on the station at that time. So we started to collaborate, and as I say, we became friends and worked together very closely in 2001, 2002. But as fate would have it, it's been about 13, 14 years, I guess, we haven't worked together, and we really haven't been able to see each other very much at all. But, you know, Michael, as fate would have it, Kellia always remembered my birthday, August 15th, and this last August, she contacted me through email, and she did astrology, was one of the many things she did, and for my birthday, she told me she was going to do something called a solar return for me, which she did. It was pages and pages of astrology, which she emailed me on August 15th as a gift for my birthday. And then we had another email exchange on the 16th. And then sometime later, on an email listserv that has to do with KPFA, someone had posted that Kelia died in her sleep on the 18th of August, so not 2 days after my last interaction with her. And I must say it came as quite a shock. I still can't believe that she's no longer with us.
Well, that's really something. What about, as I mentioned before, she had a key role in the founding of the show Guns and Butter. Could you tell us about how the role specifically that she played in establishing that venerable institution?
Well, absolutely, and it's very important. And I would like to start by saying that there would be no Guns and Butter show if it weren't for Kelia Ramirez. It was her idea. She came up with a name for it. It was really her determination and persistence that got us the show. In order to sort of briefly, I mean, it's a very long and convoluted story about how it happened, because it was next to impossible to get a new show on KPFA. It was very, very rarely ever done. But we were working together in the news department in 2001, and because of the attacks of September 11th, the station went to special programming. They canceled all their regular shows, and they did 24/7 reporting on 9/11. So Kelia saw that as an opportunity for us to get on the air and start doing some of the economic financial reporting that I had wanted to do and that she thought was a good idea. So Kelia got us 3 half-hour time slots to produce economic reporting. And when we got those time slots, then of course it was, well, gee, what are we going to do? Because we'd never done shows before. I read an article by an ex-LA cop named Mike Rupert on the massive put options on United and American Airlines and the reinsurance companies that reinsured some of the companies in the Twin Towers. And I forwarded this article to Kelia, and she seized upon it immediately and said, this is what we're going to do. And she got a hold of Mike Rupert, and we went on air with him live on October 12th, 2001, and we did a live show with him on the put options and also on the Promise software that he claimed the U.S. intelligence used to monitor the stock market in real time. So the show became a show on the attacks of September 11th, and in, of course in those days the analysis was geopolitical and foreknowledge. That's kind of where we were. I'd also like to mention, because this is the Global Research News Hour, that the second show we did live was with Michel Chosadovsky on the attack on Afghanistan, which he characterized as a war of aggression. And then from time to time, Kelia would get us airtime, you know, over the holidays, maybe when we could get on and do some other programming. The other significant a show that we did together, and I really think this needs to be mentioned, was the following February 2002. Kelia again was the one that did it. She got us an hour on the fundraiser, and we offered as a premium the first tape that was ever made on September 11th, which was Mike Rupert's Truth and Lies of September 11th. And that fundraiser was a smashing success. Incredible success, but it also lit a fuse at the station and brought in criticism of the subject matter of Michael Rupert. There's a well-known media figure who wrote into the station and claimed that the subject matter and Mike Rupert in particular should not be allowed on the air to hawk his wares. So a controversy, a big one at the station, broke out, and there was a sort of an informal censorship of the subject, and particularly of Michael Rupert. And I think that's what infuriated Kelia so much that she became determined that she and I were going to have our own public affairs show. And she insisted that it was going to be an hour long, not a half hour, a weekly show. And, you know, I'll have to say, Michael, I don't think I really wanted that. I kept saying, you know, I don't know about this, Kelly. I was not so gung-ho. But it was her idea, and she wrote the program proposal. We went before the program council. Of course, neither one of us thought in a million years they were going to give us a show. Neither one of us were expecting that. And so when we got the show, it was quite a shock, a very big shock. You know, and I'd like to say that Kelly had a really strong personality. She was fearless, very hardworking, dedicated to what she believed in, very much unafraid to confront the powers that be. In this case, of course, that was the paid staff, the management at the station. And I can't say how much it was really her doing that got us the show. So it's kind of ironic how things work out in life. We were given a start date of September 11th, 2002, for our regular hour-long weekly show. And it was before our start date that Kelly decided that she wasn't going to do the show. She went to management and dropped out and said to give the show to Bonnie. And she probably had her own reasons, many of her own reasons, why she decided she wouldn't or couldn't do it. I think it was mostly the bottom line. She didn't have the resources to go to work full-time on a volunteer basis, on a strictly volunteer basis. And so I think that's pretty much why I ended up holding the bag, so to speak. And here I am, Michael, 13, 14 years later, and I'm still holding the bag, thanks to Kelly. I don't know whether to thank her or curse her.
Yeah, and that Guns and Butter at that point, like we're talking around the 2000, late 2001, early 2002. This was a time when it was not at all fashionable to go into the whole 9/11 truth realm. That was, I mean, it's still kind of frowned on today, but back then it just wasn't done. So it sounds like Guns and Butter, and by extension, Kelly Ramirez, played a very key role in this rather important movement.
Oh, absolutely and totally. No, it was verboten. It really, I mean, even to this day, Michael, the staff at KPFA don't do 9/11 programming. No, we were a couple of voices crying in the wilderness, and we had to go up against everyone to do the show. It was it's an understatement to say that it was unpopular. It was actually amazing that we got the show, and I think it was because of the controversy. Well, Kelly was convinced that it was because of the controversy swirling around the sort of informal censorship and some of the outrage that the listeners had. Censorship on free speech radio. And I think, and Kelly was convinced that's why we got the show. It was because of that. And so it's been a difficult position to be in. But I must say, Kelly could certainly hold her own, and she was not afraid of controversy or confronting the rest of the staff at KPFA about what she believed in. I have to hand it to her. Without her, well, I've said it before and I'll say it again, without Kelly, there wouldn't be any show, Guns and Butter. And it's kind of ironic that I ended up producing the show by myself.
Hmm. I was wondering if there's maybe an anecdote you can share, maybe a specific moment, not necessarily behind the mic, but just something that's memorable for you that you're going to be carrying forward, maybe a favorite memory of Kelly and the two of you working together.
Well, she was a lot of fun to work with, I should say. Very smart, very hardworking, very tenacious, and we had a lot of fun together, but we were both kind of workaholics. And I'll have to say, Michael, there's something about radio that's addictive. I think we both became addicts to it. And we would, for one thing, when we did the fundraiser and offered Truth and Lies of 9/11, we recorded a 3-hour speech of Mike Rupert's in San Francisco. And we stayed up all night long at the station editing that thing. And Kelly, well, actually, it was Kelly who knew how to digitally edit in those days. I didn't. She sat there editing that thing, and I sat with her all night long. We didn't even have any sleep before we went on air. But that's how determined she was and hardworking. She was really a dynamo when it came to hard work. And she didn't have it easy. You know, she needed paid work, and she got paid work. But, you know, radio doesn't pay very much. So I think things were always a struggle for her, and for me, too. But particularly for Kelly, it's quite a struggle to stay in radio with that kind of dedication and the very little remuneration and thanks that we all get. It's a hard job. I don't think people who listen to radio realize how difficult it is to really produce a good show. It takes a lot of work.
Indeed. I was wondering if you might, before you go, if there is something that you'd like to add about how you feel Kelia should be remembered. What legacy is she leaving behind?
Well, I would say the thing that I admire her for was her dogged pursuit of the truth, or whatever she considered the truth to be. We shared that characteristic, and I think it's one of the reasons that we worked together so smoothly those first 2 years. I admire her tenacity and, well, just her hard work and her standing up for what she believed in. You know, it's not easy to go against the wave of public opinion, of the opinions of coworkers of the station. And I think it was very difficult for her. She went on and continued to work in the news department there for many years. But, you know, most of the station was not in agreement with what we were doing. So I really admire her bravery, her courage. And I mean, that's her courage and her adherence to the truth as she saw it. I admire her for that, her integrity, really.
Bonnie Faulkner, thank you very much.
Oh, well, Michael, thank you so much for doing this show. I think it's greatly needed. I'm so happy to hear that you're doing a show on Kelly Ramirez, and I look forward to hearing it.
Okay. Thanks so much. Bonnie Faulkner is the longtime producer and host of Guns and Butter, a one-hour public affairs program airing on Pacifica radio stations, KPFA and WBAI.
Kelly has started contributing some of her pre-recorded work to the Global Research NewsHour in 2015. What follows is a sample from one of those broadcasts. This is an interview with Tracy Rosenberg of the progressive media advocacy group Media Alliance, which aired in May of 2015. It explores the topic of media concentration and its impacts on democracy.
Tracy Rosenberg has worked in the San Francisco Bay Area as Media Alliance's executive director since 2007. According to its website, Media Alliance, quote, was founded with the belief that in order to ensure the free and unfettered flow of information and ideas necessary to maintain a truly democratic society, media must be accessible, accountable, decentralized, representative of society's diversity, and free from covert or overt government control and corporate dominance. Media Alliance is a media resource and advocacy center for media workers, nonprofit organizations, and social justice activists. Unquote. Rosenberg has organized and advocated for the protection and sustainability of alternative media outlets and for fair representation of women and minorities in the mainstream media. Rosenberg has been very active in the battles for net neutrality and against the merger of media giants Comcast and Time Warner. In an afternoon crammed with conference calls about the merger, she graciously fit me in for a conversation about media monopoly.
They're all getting bigger.
Ben Bagdikian, who wrote The New Media Monopoly, now in its 20th edition, says in that book that five conglomerates control 90% of what Americans see, read, and hear.
Yes.
What do Americans have to fear about these conglomerates, especially politically?
I think what's most scary about huge media companies, just as with large corporations in other sectors of the economy, is that they essentially become larger than the public. They become global entities in terms of the resources that they have, the funds that they bring, the political alliances that they make. So essentially, they're functioning outside of the sort of national and governmental borders that have been set up. And these borders, as much as government can be a problem, are really the only way that the public can express their limitations on these companies. So you essentially end up with sort of a global corporate super order. And I think that we're seeing that not just with the natural resources of the world, but we're also seeing it with our information economy and our information resources.
Is this sort of media consolidation happening internationally?
The internet has essentially collapsed those borders. In other words, we're all getting and providing information across national borders. English is becoming the language of the universe. It always has been for a long time now. And we're not really seeing discrete boundaries between these kinds of communications. One of the most read news outlets in the United States is The Guardian UK. So we're not really recognizably talking about national media anymore. We're talking about global information, which is flying all across the universe. So the rules and the regulations and the brakes on this process really don't compute with our national governments and the institutions that have been set up to regulate. They're not working in the right spheres.
Plus, now we have the specter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, alias NAFTA on steroids.
And the point of the TPP is to essentially collapse government in favor of global corporate hegemony. And the question here is, for natural resources, for the environment, this is a catastrophe. What's the impact for our information resources and for the tools and the methods and the platforms that we use to talk to each other if they too are essentially owned by a global corporate hegemony that answers to no one?
Does the fact that two out of the five major media conglomerates in the U.S. are based beyond our borders mean anything per se?
I don't think that because a media outlet per se is foreign, that it's better or worse than a domestic media outlet. What the threat is, essentially, is the size and the comparative power of these entities and the fact that their interests really span nations in terms of the resources that they can marshal and the way that they politically interact when their interests are at stake, which is almost beyond national governments. And it's certainly beyond the somewhat pathetic regulatory entities that are set up.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We also air on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM and our podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. This week, we are airing a special radio tribute to the life and work of independent print and broadcast journalist Kelia Ramirez Watson, who passed away in August of 2015. Frida Werden is an award-winning radio producer based out of Denman Island in BC. She was the spoken word coordinator with CJSF for about a decade. From 2002 to 2007, she served as vice president for North America on the International Board of Directors of AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters. She's the co-founder and producer of WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service, a syndicated podcast by and about women. She joins us by phone. Thank you very much for joining us, Frida.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael.
Now, I know that Kelia Ramirez Watson was a frequent contributor to WINGS over the more than a decade, and I guess I was just wondering if there's anything that you know,
you have any specific recollection of how and when you first got connected with her?
I really can't remember exactly how I met Kelia, but probably it was in Berkeley at KPFA, because I was in and out of there often over the years. There, lots of radio conferences took place in that area and so forth. So I think we probably met at a conference.
Okay. Of course, you've produced both in the United States, produced radio both in the United States and in Canada. You've met Kelia in person.
Yes. I think maybe we first met in person, and then over the years I saw her a few times. One time she came to stay with me for about a week in Texas, and that was really enjoyable. I liked working personally with her in the studio.
Yeah, what did you like about working with her?
Well, she was really committed and focused on radio. For a long time, she supported her radio habit by working freelance, editing for law journals, but she was a major volunteer at KPFA, worked in the news for a really long time, and she took the work really seriously and came through on deadlines, and she always had an idea that she wanted to pitch, and quite often it was something that we did want to have for Wings.
Mm. Well, do you have any insights into her specific motivation in terms of, like, what, you know, why she was so passionate about this particular endeavor?
I don't know why she got hooked on radio, but, you know, so many of us do. Once you start working in radio, it can become a delightful habit. But she wanted to communicate ideas, and she was very scornful of the mainstream media on so many fronts and felt that there was a lot to be said from alternative perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
One of the shows that I remember that she did for us was with some interviews with Ellen Brown, who is an economic journalist and had very interesting insights about the banking industry. And another thing that she did that I remember was there was an arts collective in Oakland and how they worked with the community and gave people free art supplies and worked on community activities. So those were, you know, some of the ideas that she had. She was very much of an anti-monetarist. She believed basically that we'd be better off without money, and I know she was working on a book about that. And so she liked to interview people, women who worked on the gift economy or things about the money economy and that should be changed. Mm-hmm. And also, she could be a really good editor of things that that she had not recorded herself. So she worked on a two-part series about based on a TV series of women in different countries and things that they had done against war.
Yeah.
And also anti-nuclear. She was very good on interviews with women in the environmental and anti-nuclear movement. There were so many themes that she covered for Wings over a period of at least 15 years, maybe more than that.
Yeah, I know that certainly she's contributed to the Global Research News Hour, and it's, I mean, not extensive as nearly as extensively as to Wings, because she just barely started with us this year. But I was quite her productions were quite notable for their professionalism and thoroughness of the subject in exploring the subject matter.
Right, and she did a lot of research for her scripts, too. She would always set up, you know, what was the situation and so forth. It wasn't just raw interviews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there anything, maybe on a personal note?
She loved baseball, and that was really strange to me. She was a great fan of some particular baseball player, and she had a blog about him, and so she had other interests that I didn't really share at all, but it was good to know about. Also, she was really into, I'm not sure if she called it Wicca or something like that, but she was a pagan, and her wedding was a pagan ceremony. and she enjoyed that kind of thing. She lived very frugally, and because she spent almost all her time doing radio, quite often without pay. It was only in the last few years that she made her living doing that, and it was a scrimpy living. It was difficult for her. And at one point, she was hired by Genevieve Vaughn, the advocate of gift economy, to edit some work for her. But mostly, she was just doing radio.
Do you feel that she got the kind of recognition that she deserved?
No. I really don't think so. And, of course, that's what she thought, too, that she didn't get the recognition, for example, at KPFA, the radio station, where she was so devoted to the news and then was kind of pushed out, she thought, for somebody else, at least on some occasions. But she hung in there. You know, she'd go back. She would go back and try to stick to the jobs that meant something to her. She was a very dogged individual. She was a short woman and just had that kind of serious expression on her face a lot of the time when we were talking about news and that kind of thing. And she took advice very seriously, and she'd try to compromise between what she wanted to put in the show and the restrictions of the show. She did like to push her particular passions, but she was a damn good editor and producer, and it's a huge loss to Wings, and I'm sure it is to you, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, how do you think we could, do you have any thoughts about how we could best honor the legacy of Miss Ramirez Watson?
Oh, I mean, talking about her on the radio is certainly a good way to do it. I think she would have liked that.
Mm.
I'm glad you're doing a program about her.
Yeah, well, certainly the least we could do. Frieda Weirden, I want to thank you very much for sharing your own memories with our program, and all the best for Wings and for CJSF and everything else that you're doing out there in Radioland.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Frieda Weirden, award-winning radio broadcaster
and producer of Wings. The following interview, which last aired on Wings the week of her death, features a Korean War survivor and unification activist discussing the devastating impacts of that war, which never really ended, and other dimensions of that largely misrepresented conflict.
I walked into a women's restroom on April 28, 2001, during Project Censored's Press Freedom Conference at San Francisco State University, and found a small Korean woman urgently telling the others in line that the U.S. military was using islands in South Korea for bombing practice.
50 years of bombing practice at U.S. bombing range at Maehyeongri using depleted uranium. The people live, the villages are within 1 mile range.
So you're saying 1 mile range of bombing with depleted uranium?
Yes. We want U.S. troops out of Korea.
We found an empty classroom for a longer talk. The woman was Wai-Young Lee, Director of International Relations for the Pan-Korean Alliance for the Reunification of Korea, USA. Lee is a nurse, a mother, a Korean War refugee, and the daughter of a disappeared political activist. She is publicizing a People's War Crimes Tribunal investigating U.S. war crimes against the Korean people. According to Lee, the United States has a lot to answer for.
I am working for Korea Truth Commission to reveal the Holocaust, I would call it. More than 2.5 million civilians were massacred from 1950 to 1953 during 3 year Korean War. That's outnumbered 10 years of Vietnam War. I call it Holocaust.
We are finding out recently about a massacre that occurred in Korea, Nogunri. But are you saying there were other places where the United States massacred civilians in Korea?
Since the Nogunri was revealed in September of 1999, 160 locations from south and north, the villages, the people have come out saying that we had the similar story or even worse, much worse than Nogunri story.
How were these genocides carried out?
I was 7 years old in 1950 when the full-blown war broke out. I have witnessed bodies. I had to walk over bodies and bodies as a refugee. I have witnessed the American soldiers looking for women to rape, house to house, room to room, regardless of age, from children to elderly women, war victims. And they murdered them. They take out their breasts, poke out their eyes, women and children. They throw the children, crying children, into the flame after they burned the villages. They try to save the bullet. They use one bullet to kill about 20 tied in one line with rope and shoot them with one bullet and drop them into shaft, bury them alive. These 160 locations, the people come out and telling their stories, horrible stories. 1/6 of South Korean population, 1/3 of North Korean population were murdered during this Korean War by U.S. military.
I would like to know how it is that you and your mother had the good fortune not to be raped by the American soldiers.
My father was a medical doctor, and fortunately, he was able to speak English somewhat and able to communicate, and he was the only person wherever we went that the U.S. troops can communicate, and also most U.S. troops did not have the doctor with them, so they used my father, the troops. The officers usually used to hang around with my father in my place. Even then, my mother could not be visible, and she always hid it behind the ration boxes. The officers brought a lot of ration boxes to us, and we piled them up, and my mother hid it behind it. And I had to go inside that small area for my mother to comb my hair every morning, French braided. And one day, my father and one of the officer, U.S. officer, and me went for a picnic to a mountain. And while my father stepped away, this U.S. officer asked me, "Where's my mom?" I made a motion that my mom was bombed and killed. And he asked me, "Who is braiding your hair?" And I made a motion that I did it myself, and he took off that braid and asked me to redo it, and I could not do it. And another instance was that while we are moving as a refugee moving, we had to walk day after day, night after night, month after month. And during the move, my mother has to come out of a shelter. And my mother and I, we were walking alongside the rice field, picking up the edible vegetables. And this U.S. soldier approached us and harassing us. And he was frustrated that my mother did not respond. And he went to my father and told my father that to tell that woman that I want her. And my father happened to sharpen knife at that moment and told the U.S. soldier that she is my wife. My mother and I were not raped. Still, my brother, 2 years older than me and myself, were used as a throwing ball between U.S. soldiers. They threw us as a ball to each other. They didn't care what happened to if they drop us, what happened to us.
Another former colleague of Kelly Ramirez Watson was Anthony Fest, producer and host of Weekend News for KPFA. He could not spare time for a formal interview, but wanted to share some thoughts about one aspect of Kelly in particular that stood out for him. He writes, "Most of you know of Kelly because of her journalism, but let me tell you about another facet of her life, which may come as a surprise. Kellya was a big-time sports fan, a baseball fan to be specific, and in the time I knew Kellya, her baseball loyalties were not linked to a particular team, but instead to a particular player, Eric Burns. I don't know how that came to be, but that's how it was. Kelia rooted for whichever team had Eric Burns on its roster. Burns began his MLB career with the Oakland A's, and perhaps that's how Kelia noticed him. With Kelia living in the Oakland area, the A's were the local team, and you'd see Kelia wearing an A's cap or jacket. But it's the nature of baseball that players change teams frequently, owing to trades and the free agent system. In 2006, Burns became an Arizona Diamondback, so Kelia put away her A's regalia and procured some Diamondbacks gear to wear. I recall her grousing about the stress this put on her limited budget. Also, since the Diamondbacks play in the National League, they weren't often seen in Oakland, so Kelia would make her way over to San Francisco when the D-backs were visiting the Giants. For time, Burns went through a hitting slump and Kelia was worried, so she wrote a letter to the Diamondbacks manager suggesting that the problems might be and how he might fix them. As I recall, it had to do with the mechanics of batting. Surprise, sometime later, she told me she'd received a reply from the manager thanking her and saying, among other things, quote, "You're obviously an insightful student of the game," unquote. Burns changed teams at least once more before retiring, when he joined the Seattle Mariners. I don't recall seeing Kelia in Mariners gear. Perhaps by then she'd drawn the line about buying costly sports logo gear. So, if you only knew Kelia through her work, rest assured she wasn't only about work. Important to her, though, that was. Arkelia had a fun side, too, and as you can tell by the anecdote above, she was very serious about her fun. Anthony Fest, producer and host of the Weekend News at KPFA-FM, Berkeley, California. There were other dimensions to Kelia's character as well. She was, in fact, a practicing pagan, and part of a spiritual group in the San Francisco Bay Area known as the Hermetikoi. Their dedication to the revival of the worship of the ancient Greek gods appealed to her interest in Hellenic culture. She claimed that she turned to this group to help her make sense of the departure of Mike Rupert. I first reached out to Kelia Ramirez Watson on behalf of the Global Research NewsHour in early 2014, shortly after the death of Rupert, for a tribute show I was putting together for him at the time. This was the first and only interview I ever conducted with the journalist. I enclose now an excerpt from that interview. The death of Mr. Rupert, to my knowledge, none of these, Democracy Now or any of these other higher-ups have even acknowledged his death, even though...
I wouldn't be surprised, and I will tell you frankly that I had left KPFA in July of 2010 over budgeting issues. I then came back this January for a little bit to do a day a week of volunteer reporting in return for access to their studio afterward. Excuse me. And I had withdrawn 2 weeks ago because I have a paid freelance project to do. But now that I know that Mike is dead, I am never, ever darkening their door again, because I'm sitting there saying, why am I even in the same halls with these people? I've got to find some better way to work than with these lily-livered leftists who have really, I believe, seriously contributed to Mike's demise, because somebody who's done that kind of hard work for so long needs some validation. Mm. And even after you got information from Cheney and Condoleezza Rice that they knew something ahead of time, it was on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle, still these people were ignoring Rupert and putting him down. And, you know, I don't want anything more to do with them. I really don't.
Okay. Well, you've I guess you've at least partially addressed my question. Like, what impact has Mike Rupert and his work had on your approach to journalism and your perspective on the issues?
Well, I think that Mike now approached things in a very good way. He used multiple sources. His approach was to use the best sources he could find that were publicly available to show us that we had we were being told what was going on. We just weren't paying attention because it was one thing here, one thing there. He, in a sense, is telling us all, you have to read different sources. You just can't stick to KPFA, or if you're a conservative, to Fox News, and believe that, you know, the font of all wisdom is one show. I never wanted that firm for me. And I think that we I have to, for me, look further afield. He talked to the best people he could, and I happened to be the one who introduced him to Colin Campbell, the dean of the Peak Oil, the Peak Oil people. The idea that you have to talk to people regardless of their gender, their race, their geographic location. You just look at who has the best information. And that's where I had some problems with some shows in Pacifica, like Free Speech Radio News. I contributed to that a bit. The Pacifica style is to be very ID politics oriented. We have problems now, like the energy problem, like the fallout politically of 9/11, issues that will affect everyone regardless of their race or their gender or their even their socioeconomic background or their where they live, and we have to be looking at those issues and not deal with, oh, it's this is the gay hour and this is the women's show and this is the show for hip-hop youth and that kind of thing. Where I think I personally belong and where I am trying to do now is the issue of money. Mike Rupert said, if you don't change the way money works, you don't change anything. I am a step ahead of him on that, and I think that may have been part of why I kind of didn't hear from him again is for a while, is that I believe you have to abolish money, and it's concomitant values of paying, owing, earning, deserving. Who is anybody that can say to us, you have to be profitable to me in order for you to have resources? Because I believe that we really are all equal. And a person's height, weight, size, money in their pocket is only a surface thing. We all come from the same source. We're all born from a woman. We all mature and we learn our ABCs before we read Shakespeare, and we all die. Mm. We're all mortal, and you can't take it with you. And until people realize that, they're going to be busy pushing their differences and, oh, you're a maker, and I'm a maker, and you're a taker, and blah, blah, blah. And it's all a bunch of shallow garbage that is not anything true and deep. What Mike really wanted to do, which is something that I also want to do, is get to the very bottom of why something is. In this age of 24/7 journalism, we nevertheless are going to shorter and shorter and shorter pieces, and we don't have time to really look at why something is happening, which is the primary question of the investigative reporter. Mike Rupert was an investigative reporter. I try to be. I lack the resources that he had, but the person who asks why is not being given enough time in media, and I think that really needs to change. That plus having people just look at different things. You know, I check the New York Times, and I read things on the Internet as well. We have to learn to vary our sources, and then we'll see what the government and what the corporations have actually put out there right before our eyes, but just in various places.
Kelly Ramaris Watson had published one volume of poetry entitled Near the Ragged Edge of Earth. She had authored the ebook Eating Poison, Food, Drugs, and Health, which examines how public health is jeopardized by junk food, processed food, and prescription drugs. It was Kelly's partner, David, who informed me by email of how she passed away peacefully in her sleep due to an undiagnosed condition. Kelly Ramirez Watson died at the age of 60. We cannot hope to capture all aspects of this remarkable person in a one-hour broadcast. However, we are hopeful that listeners may get some sense of her as a largely unsung hero of independent journalism and will have their curiosities engaged to the point of exploring her work on their own, doing their own research, as Kelia would no doubt have approved. As someone who has been involved in independent media myself for roughly 7 years, I am respectful of Kelia's passion for real journalism and her uncompromising commitments to social justice and truth-seeking. From what I know of her, she was a reporter in the finest sense of the word, and I, for one, am inspired by her accomplishments. I am likewise disappointed that the exposure and recognition she deserved was denied her while she lived. This program will soon appear on the Global Research website, along with a list of links to Global Research articles and interviews she has produced over the course of her career. It is not comprehensive and likely will not do her justice, but it is a small attempt to bring her work to the attention of the wider public. That concludes our program. If you have comments or concerns about this or any other Global Research News Hour broadcast, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. This program was produced and hosted by me, Michael Welch, out of CKUW 95.9 FM on the University of Winnipeg campus in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Thank you for joining us. Please join us again next week.